The concerns about forest practices in our region start with weather and where to cut trees, but extend into many other subject areas, and pesticides are a big subject area. The Eugene-based group Beyond Toxics just released a report on pesticide use on private forest land. Full title is Oregon's Industrial Forests and Herbicide Use, a Case Study of Risk to People, Drinking Water, and Salmon. And that not only details the effects of some pesticide use in the Willamette Valley, it also details the usual difficulty in obtaining records to track such use on private land. We have two guests with us on the exchange. Lisa Arkin is the executive director at Beyond Toxics. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Good morning.
Good morning. Peter Hayes is with us as well. He's a former member of the Oregon Board of Forestry. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good morning.
Good morning. So, Lisa, tell us about the process of preparing the report. What prompted it?
This report was prompted, first of all, by the exposure investigation that was conducted by federal and state agencies in West Lane County. A lot of people know it as the Triangle Lake investigation. And the reason that prompted our work is because it was the first time ever that the public has had access to spray records. So a spray record is the document that's kept by the person who conducts the spray application, and it tells you exactly what was used and how much and when and what the weather was. Getting access to this document allowed us to conduct the first ever analysis of industrial forest practices of using helicopters to aerial spray herbicides across a very vast forest landscape.
Peter Hayes is a former member of the Oregon Board of Forestry. You're somewhat closer to the state apparatus or work. What is the reason that these records are generally kept confidential?
I think it fits with some of the history of how things are done. Some of it was logistical, that in times past it was mechanically difficult to share records, which is no longer the case. And I think that there's this political pressure to honor the rights of landowners to do what they want, perhaps above the rights of neighbors to be safe.
And so, Lisa Arkin, what materials were you able to bring in that were not generally available?
I'm sorry, Jerry, could you repeat that question?
The materials that were available to you for the purposes of this report, let's get specific about what's in them and what you found.
Okay. So a spray record is supposed to be filled out directly after a spray operation is conducted, and it tells you which pesticide products were used, which adjuvants were used. These are chemicals that are added in to make a pesticide stick or to not foam up. The time of the application, where it was done. So we analyzed that by using GIS mapping, the weather, and a lot of details about the actual pesticide spray. And this has not been available before. There is something called a notification that you can pay money to get, which will notify you of a forestry operation intent to spray, but it doesn't tell you a date, it doesn't tell you the chemical, it doesn't tell you how much or the rate of spray.
It sounds like it's more like this is an invitation to leave your home for a little while that day, notice.
Yeah, maybe, if you can find out what day.
Oh, but they don't even tell you that much.
Yeah, no, it gives generally an entire year. It says a spray may occur within the next year. And so you have no idea when it might occur, and most people don't know till they hear the helicopter off in the distance, and then they generally pack the kids in the car and grab a few things and run, because this stuff drifts off the private industrial forest land where it's sprayed onto other people's private property, onto drinking water resources, onto salmon streams, things like that.
Peter Hayes, differentiate for us, if you would, between the differences in pesticide applications on private forest land in Oregon and public forest land. There are some differences, correct?
Yes, there are. And I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on it, but that on our federal lands, there are much restricted uses, and my understanding is there is not aerial spraying. A good forest to look at would be the Siuslaw National Forest that has been quite active with this issue for some time. And that on most of the large private lands, it's assumed that it's just a standard component of doing business, so it's regularly used. Although within that spectrum, there are private landowners, including ourselves, who have found ways to use either no or very low herbicides. So it isn't a case that there is no other alternative. There is an alternative.
So, Lisa Arkin, in addition to the ability to actually get some records in here of the spraying, what's the real takeaway from your report at Beyond Toxics?
We learned a number of things that were previously unknown. I think one of the biggest takeaways is that there's a practice of mixing different types of poisons in a single tank mix. We kind of call it a chemical soup. And how this chemical soup can contain 4 to 5 different chemicals that have never been tested in the environment for their toxicity and synergistic effects. And yet these tank mixes are sprayed over salmon streams, directly into stream channels if it's a headwater or a upper tributary. It can be sprayed very close to homes, just 60 feet away from a salmon stream. And there's no research to show what is the use of these chemicals. Is it better to have a tank mix, or is it more toxic to the longevity of the ecosystem? That was a big takeaway. The other one is that in the 3 years of data that we were able to access, the amount of chemicals increased by 99%. And of that 99%, 2,4-D, which is a chemical that has been known to be a carcinogen, increased by 80%, and atrazine, which is a chemical known to be a hormone disruptor, increased by 73%. These two chemicals were the ones that were found in two sets of urine analysis done on the residents in the Triangle Lake area. So they were found in their bodies.
And how many people were tested for the urine, and how many turned up positive?
The first test that was done in the spring, 100% of the people tested turned up positive for both 2,4-D and atrazine. And in the second set of tests in the fall, it was a high number. It wasn't quite 100%, and people were testing positive for 2,4-D.
This is a fairly small sample, though, isn't it? Fewer than 50 people?
Yeah, it was about 43 people.
Is that considered large enough to get a good feel for what the situation is?
Well, what the researcher from the United States Centers for Disease Control said about her lab analysis, finding 2,4-D and atrazine in 100% of the people, is that it's highly unusual. It was found at levels higher than would be expected and higher than is found amongst pesticide applicators, things like that. So she felt it was enough of a number of participants in the study to raise a red flag.
All right. So above background levels, but is it still below something like actionable levels or levels that are considered of concern for health purposes?
Well, there is no health standard for atrazine, so we have no idea. And there is a what they call a health level for 2,4-D, but there's really no research done to know if that's okay in a 5-year-old where it was found, or what it means for a child to have both 2,4-D and atrazine in their body at the same time, and to have that chronically year after year as these chemicals are sprayed near their homes. So there's a lot we don't know about the health impacts of these chemicals in our bodies.
We're talking about the report from Beyond Toxics about pesticide use on private forest land. The study is called Oregon's Industrial Forests and Herbicide Use, a case study of risk to people, drinking water, and salmon. Lisa Arkin is the executive director of Beyond Toxics. Peter Hayes is with her, a former member of the Oregon Board of Forestry. You can join this discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I understand, Lisa, there was some responsibility. Weyerhaeuser is one of the major landowners in the area that was studied and says they did it by the book.
Well, that's correct, because the other thing that our study revealed by having access to the spray records is we were able to do a comprehensive comparison between Oregon's Forest Practices Act and the same laws in Washington and Idaho. So by doing this analysis, we determined that Oregon has weaker laws than either of our neighboring states by far. One of the striking differences is Oregon's failure to protect surface and groundwater. So, for example, in Oregon, you can spray directly into a stream channel of a headwater or tributary of a salmon stream if you don't actually see the fish there. But that would not be the case in Washington.
Hold on. That's the standard? As long as the fish aren't there, you can spray?
Yep. That is true. There's no environmental protection for these headwater streams. And in Washington, there's protection for drinking water, which not only requires a pretty hefty buffer, a no-spray buffer, but also requires a state environmental protection analysis that allows for public comment. That is not so in Oregon. The public has no opportunity to comment. And in fact, in Oregon, any input from the agency on a pesticide spray plan is advisory only. That is the words directly from our laws. So even if the state forester would like to make a comment on a plan to spray, his comments are advisory only. There's no law requiring the spray operator to take into account what our state foresters might say.
So Peter Hayes, as a former member of the Oregon Board of Forestry, and I understand your background is in sustainable forestry, there must have been periods when you sat at that board with your jaw down a little bit about things like what Lisa's talking about.
Yes, and not only mine, that I think the board has heard over many years that the public has serious concerns about the abilities of leaders to really lead on this issue. So it's not a new topic, and I think there's been a lot of loss of public trust and the ability of leaders to obey the law and fulfill their responsibilities.
Well, and as far as managing, we're talking pesticide use generally comes after the cutting, correct? The trees are gone, and then the pesticide use is generally herbicide use is there to keep the other vegetation that is non-tree stuff from cropping up and crowding out the resources that would otherwise go to trees. Are there ways, in your opinion, as a person who's into sustainable forestry, that you could manage the land without the use of pesticides and herbicides?
There are a couple of issues. Hold on a second. Excuse me. The answer is yes. And that one issue that actually leads to some use of herbicide is invasive plants, which are a separate topic. But there are many people who will use some herbicide to deal with invasive plants. But there are plenty of examples around Oregon and the rest of the Northwest of economically viable forestry that is not herbicide dependent. And the ones I'd point to would be looking at a lot of the forestry that's done on federal land, and also within the state of Oregon, there are 173,000 acres of lands that are certified under the Forest Stewardship Council standards, which instead of assuming that you will use herbicide unless proven that you don't need to, it's flipped around. So the assumption is you will use as little as possible, and you need to have a clear justification for doing it. So both landowners and consumers of wood have a choice, and the question really is, will we as growers and consumers work together to create alternative approaches, because they're definitely available to us, and the question is what we'll choose.
Lisa Arkin, I want to come back to the issue of the mixing, the pesticide soup, I believe that was the term you used. I think what you're saying is that even while each of these things may have been approved for use on landscape applications by themselves, they are not approved for use in combinations?
Oh, I didn't say they weren't approved for use in combinations. I don't think there's any monitoring going on about what's being mixed. And what we do know from studies that have been done by federal agencies, such as NOAA Fisheries, is that singly, a particular chemical such as 2,4-D may not kill a fish. But these things in combination, in small, minute amounts, can prove lethal to aquatic organisms. So, for example, we did our own monitoring in some of the salmon streams in the Triangle Lake area and found both atrazine and hexazinone. Now, we're not able to say if it was an amount that killed fish right there, but it is a concern that these chemicals are getting in the salmon streams and are mixing together in the salmon streams.
So where do you go with the report from here? You got a legislative session starting in a couple of months, but you've also got a very powerful timber industry that probably will fight you tooth and nail on any changes to either pesticide application or the reporting of them.
Well, we have made a number of recommendations in the report, which I think are sensible and reasonable. And I think number one is simply saying Oregon should be as good, if not better, than Washington and Idaho. Idaho has a buffer zone for residential areas. They call them vulnerable areas, even suburbs. We don't have any such thing in Oregon. And I think that the science that was used in our neighboring states to create sensible laws should be informing our own policy decisions in Oregon. So I think that's a number one step, and we need to make sure our laws are truly helping us fulfill our civil responsibilities to protect rural communities and to protect our forestry resources, including drinking water. You know, so many cities in Oregon get their water from rivers that come from industrial timberland. And a number of public municipal water suppliers have written letters to Senator Wyden expressing their concern that their water is not adequately protected from forestry herbicides. We need to pay a lot of attention to how we are protecting water, because in the future, water will be the number one resource that is potentially most threatened for rural communities and for cities in Oregon.
You certainly put that in a scope a lot of people can understand, even if they can write it off as like, well, that's way out in the woods, far from here. The fact is that the water they drink could indeed come from there.
Exactly. Take the water in Eugene. It comes from through our Eugene Water and Electric Board. From the McKinsey watershed, which has a lot of industrial forest activity going on there. And I was just looking at a report filed by the United States Geological Service that was done for EWEB. And in 2012, they found many of the forestry herbicides in drinking water, including 2,4-D, triclopyr, a number. You know, I'm sure the chemical names are not of interest to the public, but the fact that they're being found in the spring and the fall should be of concern.
All right. So will you be presenting this to legislators, or have you had some conversations already with them?
We are starting those conversations with legislators and our governor, and I think that the report really raises some new information about forestry herbicides that previously we didn't have to have these conversations.
And the full report is available at your website, is that right?
It sure is. You can just go to beyondtoxics.org, and there's a picture right on the homepage, and you click on that, and it takes you to the report. You can read the executive summary if you don't have time for the whole 115 pages.
All right. Oregon's Industrial Forests and Herbicide Use, a Case Study of Risk to People, Drinking Water, and Salmon, put out by Beyond Toxics. Lisa Arkin is the executive director. Peter Hayes is a former member of the Oregon Board of Forestry. Thank you both for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for covering these issues.
Thank you, Jeffrey.